monkeypox has gone from an under-the-radar disease to a national health emergency in just a couple of months. Now we seem to hear of new cases daily. And coming on the heels of the COVID-19 crisis, it's natural for people to worry about this new threat. We talked to an expert about whether you should be concerned about monkeypox and if you need to get a vaccine. And imaging exams from mammograms to MRIs are a huge benefit for patients looking to stay on top of their health. Now there's new technology that could make those exams even better and catch diseases faster. And the war in Ukraine has claimed many victims, among them more than 100 hospitals turned into rubble. But teams from the International Medical Corps are doing their best to bring relief and healing to the war-torn area. We talked to a relief worker just back from Ukraine. Fox 11 News In Depth starts right now. Hello, everyone. I'm Hal Eisner. Monkeypox. Just a few months ago, hardly anyone had heard of the disease. But as of this week, it's been declared a national public health emergency. How did we get here? While there are still relatively few people who have this disease, the myths and the fears surrounding it are growing and growing. And joining us is Dr. Matt Waxman. He's a professor of emergency medicine at UCLA. And, you know, it is an interesting thing. I mean, we come off of COVID, which is this major public health crisis, and now we hear monkeypox and not a lot of cases, but a lot of fear.
Lots of fear out there. And I think it's reasonable, given what we've all been through with COVID. I think it's important to put this in perspective and realize this is a very different disease. This is not usually spread by airborne spread. It's also not making people very sick, but those people that are getting it are really having a lot of pain and symptoms.
A lot of pain is what I hear. And so how is it transmitted? I've talked to a number of people who have said, do I need to get a shot?
Mm-hmm. So monkeypox has been endemic in Africa and identified for a number of decades. But here it's really being spread through the gay community, through males who have sex with men. It doesn't mean it's a sexually transmitted disease. It really means that it's close contact spread through that community. And the question is really who needs a vaccine or not.
But it's not a gay disease per se. I mean, we hear of all kinds of people getting it, and we've heard of children getting it as well. So tell me about that spread a little more.
Yeah, so it's really spread by rough skin contact. So skin against skin. And patients who are symptomatic, they have lesions on their body that are very painful. That's really how it's being spread. So per se, it's not a gay disease. I mean, just like the cold is not a gay disease. If you're close contact with somebody in a community, then you can get it.
But the lesions are like they're like a blister. And inside the blister is a fluid. And so it's when the fluid escapes and it gets on another person that you spread it? Is that how that works?
It's close, Hal. It's basically that any lesion, and there can be a variety of lesions in different stages. They can be red, they can be flat, they can be fluid-filled blisters, or even scars sort of at the end of the disease in that progression. But yes, it's contact with those lesions. It doesn't have to be with the fluid, any contact at all.
Could it be that somebody was in a bed, for instance, a lesion broke, and you could transmit it off of another thing, like a sheet or a blanket?
Absolutely. So that spread has been identified. That is not the most common way to get it, but it is definitely possible to get it from blankets or other linens.
Or could you get it from a kitchen counter or some other thing? So does that mean, if that's true, that we need to start dealing with sanitizers again and making sure things are clean?
In this outbreak, it's unlikely. It is not like COVID, where you can get it and not know where you usually have gotten it. These cases are easily traced. It's mainly been contact with lesions, thankfully, at this point.
Let's talk about vaccines for a moment, because what's been in the news lately is the idea of taking a vaccine and using a little bit of it and spreading it out so more people can take advantage of it. Number one, how does that work? Number two, we're not talking about everybody needs to get a shot.
Absolutely. So this vaccine was originally designed for smallpox. And the U.S. government bought a large dose of the vaccine, a large amount, in order to protect us from bioterrorism, which could happen with smallpox. Now, in terms of monkeypox, thankfully, the smallpox vaccine that we have covers monkeypox also very, very well. So we are trying to expand the supply of vaccine that we have now and sort of spread it out by giving about one-fifth the dose, just inject it under the skin, and hoping that works to expand our dose to the about 1.6, 1.7 million Americans who may need the vaccine.
So that one-fifth is as potent as the full dose?
Well, we are trying our best to figure that out. We think it's very, very close. And that comes from animal studies and really what we know about smallpox. But I think this is going to work.
Yeah, many of us as kids had allergy tests. They'd put a little needle under your skin and see if you were allergic to chocolate or ragweed or this or that. Now, this shot is now being given subcutaneously like that?
Intradermal, exactly. So it's being given just like if you had some stitches and you get a little numbing medicine under the skin, right into the skin.
And the purpose of that is?
The purpose is that we can give lesser amounts right under the skin, closer to sort of the immune cells, and not have to give as much deeper in, expand our dose of the vaccine.
Oh, talk to me about T-Tox, is that what it's called, a medication?
Yeah, so Tecovirimat is a drug that was developed for smallpox again. It works against monkeypox, and it's an antiviral medication. So there's been some controversy that the government should release the supply that we have. Right now, it's based on requests to the Centers for Disease Control if they're going to release that medication.
You mentioned smallpox, that the vaccine was the same thing for smallpox. So when I got a smallpox vaccination as a kid, I think I still have the scar.
I'm sure you do.
Yeah.
Or you remember it.
I sure do. But is that still good for me?
Probably not. This far out, your immunity to smallpox has probably waned by now.
All right. So I guess, you know, one other thing is if you get this thing, it's very painful.
Very painful.
How do you deal with that? And number two, are there lingering effects?
Yeah. So what we're seeing is a little different than the African experience. What we're seeing is very painful anal genital regions and that kind of classic rash on the hands and feet. Sometimes people start with some weakness, some being tired, some nausea, some vomiting early on in the disease. And really, we're reserving the medications for severe disease. So Tecovirimat's really being reserved for people who are at risk of dying of this.
Yeah, you're over at the ER at UCLA. You seen much of this coming in the doors there?
Where I work, I've seen one or two cases of this. We've had a couple thousand cases documented here in Los Angeles County.
This just one real quick response. This really fascinates you, this particular one.
It really does, because I've worked in Africa. I've worked on the Ebola virus in Africa. And this one is really interesting to me in the sense of spillover, that diseases that were confined to one continent in the world are now being spread, whether it's through air travel, close contact, climate change, really into our own hemisphere.
All right, Dr. Matt Waxman, good to see you. Thanks
good
for coming in. Appreciate it. Coming up next on Fox 11 News In Depth, you're getting your regular checkups, aren't you? All the scans you need to keep yourself healthy. Well, can those scans be more accurate? Could they be more detailed? We'll talk about all of that coming up on Fox 11 News In Depth. Welcome back to Fox 11 News In Depth. I'm Hal Eisner. Doctors count on medical imaging to detect tumors or other matters of concern while they are small and more easily treatable. But analyzing those images is time-consuming and puts a lot of pressure on radiologists. But RadNet has some new solutions using AI, artificial intelligence, to help spot abnormalities. In fact, in a recent study, one of those tools was shown to have potential to detect breast cancer 1 or 2 years earlier than currently known, and that's pretty remarkable. Joining us right now, Dr. Gregory Sorensen. He's the founder and CEO of DeepHealth, RadNet Incorporated. Doctor, good to see you. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. We put a lot of faith in those screening tests we get, whether they're routine like mammograms or tests looking for evidence of a tumor. How accurate are they really on a general basis?
You know, Al, they're quite accurate. Screening tests are not brought to the general public until they go through rigorous testing that shows in prospective studies that patients do benefit from having these kinds of tests as a whole population. So that means the benefits outweigh the risks of having these kinds of screening studies. And that's certainly the case for mammography. It's also the case for colon cancer screening. And especially now, there's very good evidence that lung cancer screening is particularly beneficial for people who qualify. In the case of lung cancer screening, that's smokers and former smokers.
Tell us about what this new technology entails.
Yeah, you know, it's quite remarkable. The same mathematical equations that underlie Siri and Alexa, these tools that seem to be able to recognize patterns from data, are now being used in the same way to look at medical images. mammograms specifically, but other kinds of screening exams and images. And this has been a real breakthrough because I've been doing this now for many decades, and it's been a hard problem to get computers to really understand and recognize patterns in images. But these mathematical equations, this so-called deep learning, this has really changed the ability for software to help us physicians find these abnormalities.
You mentioned,
and as you said in your opening.
You mentioned
oh, go ahead.
You mentioned it's more than just for mammograms, but you know, the last couple of years dealing with COVID, a lot of people didn't do any of this stuff. They didn't want to get out in public.
Yes.
They didn't want to go anywhere. They didn't get the test. And people were showing up, according to interviews we did right here on this program, people were showing up at ERs with stage 4 cancer.
Yes. Unfortunately, there's now emerging data that by missing these screening tests, people are showing up with later stage cancer. You know, it's easy to put off, but in fact, the data are very clear, and it's kind of an unfortunate natural experiment that COVID has done. Screening really does help us catch cancer earlier, and that does save lives.
And this new technology, how does this help patients?
Well, the main thing is it helps the test be more accurate. Because we have the AI to help us physicians, we catch the cancers more frequently, and we have false positives, few false alarms. And so that means fewer women are being asked to come back for, say, an ultrasound or an MRI, and more women are having their cancers found, as you said, 1 to 2 years earlier. It's a big win.
Where is this in use, and is it becoming more widespread?
It is. We've now rolled this out across more than 200 of the RadNet centers. It was just FDA approved in May, and a lot of data and effort went in for years and years to develop and test this. And we can see that whether you're an expert physician that does this full time, whether you're a part-time physician that reads mammograms, say, a couple of days a week, now all of those physicians are at expert level. I wouldn't want my own wife's mammogram to be read without AI. It really is making a big difference.
And just to sort of repeat a little territory we covered, this is not just for women, and it's not just for mammograms.
That's exactly right. We now have these tools that help us with other kinds of imaging. So, of course, there's a whole set of AI that helps us us physicians look at the pictures better. There's also a lot of technology around AI that's going into making the pictures. It helps the MRI go faster, so the exam doesn't last as long, for example. It helps the X-ray dose come down, so it's a safer exam. Even just the throughput of the patients and the workload that the technologists have to go through, all of this is being assisted by these artificial intelligence tools. It's really helping a very positive impact in patient care.
I'm fascinated by AI. Just the whole idea of artificial intelligence is so science fiction to me. But number one, short definition of AI as you see it. Number two, where do you see all this going in the future?
Sure. So artificial intelligence today, of course, is a broad term. And what's really being used in medicine today is this form called deep learning, where we train the software on examples. So you can kind of think of it definitionally as like a really good memory. It learns from 10 or 100 lifetimes worth of images and consolidates that down into a single piece of software that can help us doctors. I call it bringing the best doctor in the world to every patient. It really distills years and years of learning, decades and decades of learning, by having this fantastic memory. And I think where this is going is we're going to have software products in the future that will start to read some of these images on their own. And you'll get a report back that says no further human review needed because the machine does such a good job of identifying which needs further medical attention and which just come back next year for your screening in a year or whatever. And I think that will broaden access, make imaging and these screening tools available to a lot of people who for today, it's harder. You know, many of us live in cities where we can go, but some people live remotely and it's hard for them to get follow-up. If we can kind of package this expertise into a software, a piece of hardware that we can then deliver remotely or out in a rural area or even in other countries, it's going to have a big positive impact on cancer detection and cancer cure rates worldwide.
Fascinating. Just fascinating. Dr. Gregory Sorensen, thanks so much for joining us. Coming up next on Fox 11 News In Depth, the crisis in Ukraine continues unabated, and one of the most tragic consequences is the destruction of more than 100 hospitals since the conflict with Russia began. But the International Medical Corps is there to help. We talk to a representative just back from that region right after the break. Be right back. Shocking statistics coming to us from the Ukrainian Health Ministry. More than 100 hospitals have been struck by bombs in that war-torn region, and the attacks on ambulances, hospitals, and medical personnel only seem to be increasing. It's hard not to feel helpless in the face of all of that trauma. But there is one organization that's doing its part to bring repair and refuge to Ukraine. That's the International Medical Corps. They have offices both here in Los Angeles and in Washington, D.C. And Todd Bernhardt is their Senior Director of Global Communications. He's just back from 3 weeks in Ukraine. Good to see you, Todd. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Sure thing.
It's not that long ago you were in Ukraine. Tell us what you saw, what it's like on the ground there.
Well, it really depends on where you are in the country. There are areas in the east, especially in the southeast, where the war is raging and where it's quite dangerous. There are areas to the north that had borne the brunt of the initial invasion. And those areas are where the Ukrainians were able to push the Russians away. And now they're working hard to rehabilitate, to rebuild. And we're, of course, helping with that effort. Down in the south of the country, along the Black Sea, they're trying to prepare for any kind of eventuality. Of course, they are trying to make sure that they're ready if an attack occurs. And then in the west of the country, which is relatively safe for now, there are a lot of internally displaced people who are trying to get on with their lives. These are people who have fled from the east, where things, as I said, are quite dangerous. And they're trying to make sure that they can continue their lives, make sure their children are educated, get gainful employment, do things like that.
Ukraine is not a new mission for your Corps. In fact, they've been helping for more than 20 years. Is that right?
That's true. We were originally there in 1999, providing training and medical services. And we've been there continuously since 2014. A lot of people forget that this is not a new war. There's been a proxy war going on since 2014 with the Russian annexation of Crimea. And there was quite a hot conflict for a long time in the southeast of the country. And we were there providing medical services and mental health services. That second part is quite important, too. People often only really see the outward signs of war, but not the inward signs and wounds of war. And we try to make sure that people get treatment for both.
What is the area of greatest need? I hear your team was helping to rebuild hospitals. Is that right?
That is true. And really, it goes back to, as I was saying, the different parts of the country are a bit different. So in the north, where the invasion was repulsed, we're working really hard on repair and rehabilitation of healthcare facilities. That means hospitals. It means primary healthcare centers where people might go to get day-to-day care. We're making sure that they can rebuild these facilities, which were often occupied and completely destroyed by Russian forces. We're making sure that they have the medicine and medical supplies that they need, that they have equipment like ambulances, or that they have oxygen concentrators or other medical equipment they need. And again, making sure that they get the training they need. Training is a big part of everything we do. That they also get the mental health care, that they get protection services. Unfortunately, people in situations where they have been displaced or have been affected by conflict, vulnerable populations like women and children, the elderly, the disabled, they need special care. We're making sure that happens. And then in the east, we're making sure that people in the conflict zones get that the medical supplies and equipment and the care that they really need. While in the south, we are helping hospitals there prepare for the eventuality of any kind of attack. And that might mean strengthening windows in case there is a blast nearby so the windows don't shatter. It could mean building out a completely functional area in the basement of the hospital. For example, in Odessa, We are in a maternity hospital there, and we've built a complete NICU, a neonatal intensive care unit, in the basement of that hospital. So these very fragile human beings are able to get the care they need in the first hours of life. Then we also want to make sure that in the West, we're getting internally displaced people the services they need. So that means care, mental health care, medical care.
How many people do you actually have over there?
Right now, we have a staff approaching 150. When the attack invasion occurred, we had about 30 people, mostly centered in Mariupol. And of course, that was a difficult situation for them.
It would be, I'd be remiss if I didn't talk just a second about your past work, because this is not the only thing you guys have done. I mean, you were in Haiti dealing with the aftermath of the earthquake there and other things as well.
That's true. We have operations in about 30 countries around the world. We're used to operating in difficult and dangerous conditions. We respond to conflict, disaster, disease. One of your previous guests talked about Ebola. We were on the front lines in the Ebola response in West Africa.
You know, these are dangerous places for people to go. And I'm wondering if you've had any casualties as a result of being in a war zone.
Well, it's hard for us to talk about. Most humanitarian organizations have suffered. We do everything we can to make sure that the security and safety of our staff are, you know, our utmost concern. And I can tell you from my time over there that every place I went, the first thing that happened was that I got a security briefing, and we had very strict security protocols in place to make sure everyone remained safe.
All right. I want to talk about your website here for a second. Your website is internationalmedicalcorps.org. And
that's
if
correct.
People go there, you got about 15 seconds. What can they find, and what kind of help might you like?
Right on the homepage, they can find a link to information about our activities in Ukraine. They can donate and help support our work. They can also find out about the other activities and aid that we are providing around the world.
Okay. Todd Bernhardt, thanks so much. Thanks for all the good work over there. And again, the website is on our screen. Appreciate your time. And we'll be back with more Fox 11 News in depth right after this break. Don't go away. And finally, if you haven't already, please check out my podcast. It's called What the Hal, and it's available wherever you subscribe to podcasts, or just go to whatthehalpodcast.com. That's it for this week's Fox 11 News In Depth. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week, everybody. And let's look at some more of those humanitarian projects conducted by the International Medical Corps. See you next time.
Thousands are being evacuated as the country prepares for a third typhoon in as many weeks.
A new case of the Ebola virus has been detected in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo.
Beirut has been hit by a massive explosion.
It has been